Christina McMahon is the Assistant Director of Juvenile Services for Multnomah County's Department of Community Justice, DCJ. She has a law degree from Willamette University College of Law. And immediately prior to joining Multnomah County, she served 6 years as director of the Douglas County Juvenile Department located in Roseburg, Oregon. Christina sits on the Child Welfare Advisory Committee, the Oregon Attorney General's Crime Victim Compliance Advisory Committee, and the Oregon State Bar Juvenile Law Section Executive Committee. She is the Oregon Juvenile Department Directors Association representative on the Juvenile Crime Prevention Advisory Committee, and she sits on the Oregon Juvenile Department Director Association's Legislative Committee and the Oregon Law Commission Juvenile Code Revision Work Group. And you think you go to a lot of meetings. Christina is going to introduce our next speaker. Christina.
Thank you. Thank you, Commissioner Shiprack. I feel very honored to be able to introduce Jonathan Cloud to you today. I've had the privilege of hearing him speak now several times, and he is a very engaging speaker who has a lot of wonderful information to share. Yesterday, he agreed. He's had a pretty busy schedule, and he changed his schedule around to accommodate us and came into town early so that he could provide a combined training for the DCJ Juvenile Services Division staff along with the Portland Police Bureau staff on the very topic of adolescent brains. So we are very appreciative of his time here with us in Portland. A little bit about his background. Jonathan is a trainer and strategic consultant for the Office of Juvenile Justice and Delinquency Prevention's Title V Juvenile Delinquency Prevention Training and Technical Assistance Programs. He has worked on OJJDP's Project Safe Neighborhoods and Weeds and Seeds initiatives. He's also been involved and is involved with the OJJDP's National Demonstration Project on the commercial sexual exploitation of children, obviously something that we're very concerned with here in Multnomah County and involved in. He also serves currently as the disproportionate minority consultant for the fourth largest county in Wisconsin, where he resides, and has also been actively involved, completed a 7-year training project for OJJDP of training law enforcement officers to work better with juveniles. He's the author of Parenting the Guardian Class, Validating Spirited Youth, Ending Adolescence and Renewing America's Greatness, which calls for empowering youth rather than controlling them. And today he will be speaking to all of us on good maladjustment, interpreting misbehavior in light of brain development. So I ask you to join me in welcoming Jonathan here today.
Great. Thank you. Thank you. Good morning. Thank you all very much for being here, for doing the things that you do, for giving me this time to work with you and to talk with you just for a little while about the most exciting thing that I'm dealing with right now, and that is adolescence, those teen years, and what the brain is doing during that time of development. It is truly a remarkable stage of development. I'm especially excited about that now because as the research has been evolving, more and more understandings are coming along that I'm excited to see, and more thinking about and rethinking of the teen years is coming into play, and so I want to bring some of that thinking to you as well. So let me start with just asking, how many of you in here are pet owners? Pet owners. Great, okay. And for the hands that are up, how many of you have ever gone through training a pet and getting it to... You're laughing about it, so it must not have been very successful, right? Well, I say that because there's a lot of thinking out there that that we want to sort of train our kids to be just as obedient and compliant as we get our pets to be sometimes. We just wish they could just learn to figure it out and just come, go, sit, stand, and just do it. Just be obedient so that we can tame them, get them under control. I'm the shared owner of this wonderful golden retriever. Love this dog. Of course, when I grew up in Winston-Salem, North Carolina, a beautiful working-class community, and my dad had dogs and German shepherds, and we raised a litter of about 10 German shepherds. And my dog was Thor. Got that name from, I don't know, I want to find out some age ranges here. How many know where Thor comes from? Comic book strips. Oh, yeah, comic book strips. Thor was the, and recently there's been a movie about Thor. So that was my dog. And I loved him because he was very trainable. He was a close companion, walked with me, did all this cool stuff with me. So now I'm sharing the raising of a wonderful golden retriever who has just gone through his training process, and it's great. This dog will now is the best fetch dog you've ever seen in the world. I mean, it's so cool. Throw it out there. And see, this was great because this is my girlfriend's dog, and we're sharing it. So I had to kind of be impressive. Show my girlfriend I could do what I need to do with the dog. And it was great to be out in the front yard. And I go, come here, honey. Watch. Throw it out there. And he runs out there, grabs it, comes right back, drops it down. And we're just out there for hours. And it just feels good to get those animals to do what we want them to do. To be obedient. And to behave themselves. And we want that from kids. I mean, at a deep underlying area, we want that from kids. Why can't we tame them too? Why can't they run and go fetch and do all the other stuff we want them to do in the way that we want them to do it? And so sometimes we use some of the same tactics with them that we use with our animals. And training a dog and most any animal is pretty simple, isn't it? It's the old operant conditioning. Now, that's researching language for when you do what I want, I'm going to give you something good. If you don't do what I want, I'm going to make you pay for it. I'm going to do something negative. Positive and negative reinforcement. Sometimes our juvenile justice systems can be fairly reduced to that. You do what you're not supposed to do, I'm going to slap you. And if you do what you're supposed to do, sometimes they don't get a reward, but you just won't get into trouble. Because we're not very good at incentives and rewarding. Because we're not very good at identifying good behavior. We just aren't. Not just you, but it's also me. We're just not good at it. We can sure zero in on that wasn't supposed to be. We can get through the course of a day and not pick up very many positive things, but the negatives we can. But that's okay, and I've got some research about that I'll be sharing with you in a minute. But sometimes we reduce our interactions and our work with kids to basically that level. How do we get them to do what they're supposed to do? We want them to be what? Obedient. Fit in. Do what we want them to do. And so it frustrates us when it doesn't work out that way. And the point I'm setting you up for is that it is not supposed to work that way. Because they are not, and kids are not, and human beings are not, they're not animals. We're very different, and we're different at the brain level. Let me tell you what you will get. You can get the behavior you want out of a human being by using rewards and punishments, and by using good training systems. But let me tell you what you won't get. You will not get greatness. Now, I want to let that one sink in. You will get someone who knows how to fit into the environments you have created, but you will not get greatness. Because greatness requires a whole different process that we're going to talk about as called positive maladjustment. We'll get there because Dabrowski has done a great work. He's one of the few theorists who sort of figured this out. But what greatness involves is, and it's not a word we're used to, but yes, we are unlike animals at the brain level because our brains are different. And I'm going to be showing you a slide on why that is in just a second. and on why kids go through a stage of disobedience and why that maladjustment is a good kind of maladjustment and what, in fact, is underway when they're going through that. What's underway? Let me just say it now. What's underway is they're trying to figure out their path to greatness. I just want to say it. They will never say that to you because they don't know that's what is going on. But they shouldn't have to say that to us because guess who is supposed to know that that's what's going on? You and I. We're supposed to know that this struggle, this reaching for something, this not being able to fit in and not being comfortable with the world around me and testing the limits and boundaries, we're supposed to know that that is a struggle for their particular path to greatness. Now, this is all based on how the brain is designed and worked. It's really some cool, fun stuff. We're going to get there pretty soon, but it will not give us greatness. So the question we have to ask is, what is it that we're really trying to create? Or do we even know what we're trying to create? And are we open to this thrust for greatness? Animals go through stages of development, from being a little puppy to being a medium-sized dog to being a big dog. Adults go through that as well. They go through stages of development, from being a baby to being a child to being whatever. But what animals don't go through is, while we share stages, we humans are unique because we go through levels. I want you to grasp that. Levels. Because the brain has a hierarchical structure, and it has four levels. And the first level is at your left, on the bottom. Second level is the feeling. Third is thinking. Fourth is the willing. These are levels. I just want to leave that sitting there for a second to say that that's why we are different from animals. That while they go through stages, as we go through stages, we go through levels of development. And level means I'm trying to become something more than what I currently am. Now, my son was very funny. My son, Jonathan Darren Cloud, not a junior because my middle name is not Darren, but got the first name in there. He is now 25 and is married and is a wonderful police officer in Miami, Florida. But before he became a police officer, he waited till he was 19 to go through his major stage of positive male adjustment. Don't ask me what that was about. Late bloomer, maybe. I don't know. Stage of maladjustment. He did the usual stuff through 13, 14, 15. You know, him and his buddies lived in a wonderful subdivision, and I knew he and his buddies would go to the clubhouse when it was closed. Now, why do kids wait until it's closed to go? What's up with that? As soon as it closes, they lock the gates, then they want to go. What's up with that? It's very, very normal. Right? If he wasn't doing that kind of stuff, I'd be very concerned. Right? Then they would go in and climb over the gate and get up on top of the clubhouse, and guess what their deal was? They'd get a running start from the clubhouse and jump into the swimming pool with no swimming trunks on. I mean, you can't hide this. You come home, I'm sitting at home, and you come home and you're drenched wet. I mean, you can't even hide it. You know? But something else is going on. It's pushing the limits. It is doing what an interesting person said, Darwin. We're going to get there in a second. I just want to let that sit there. But anyway, he went through that normal stuff. But it was 19 that he went through his major positive maladjustment. And he was in college, first year of college. Picks up the phone, calls me up, and goes, Dad, this was not the money call. Every parent in here with the kids in college, we know the money call. We know how it starts. It starts like this. Hey, Dad. That's the money call. Hey, Dad. You know, sometimes it's, hey, Pops. I don't know where Pops started, but the first time he used it, he got about $50 out of me. So I guess that, Pops, hey, Pops. Pops, every day was Pops. Pops, how you doing, Pops? Give me some money. Hey, Dad. And I hey, Darren. How you doing? He said, I'm good. And I intuitively knew something was there. And I went, well, what's up? And he said, Dad, I don't want to finish college. and I don't want to go to college, something along those lines. I instantaneously knew what that was about. First of all, because he's my son, and I'd watched him through his development growing up. Do you know what that was about? College was not a part of his path to his greatness. That's all that was about. Which means my response to that call was the right response, because I had to catch myself, because I almost said, you know what I almost said? Oh, yes, the hell you are going to finish college. Boy. You know, that's what, right? Boy. Boy means you're doing it whether you want to do it or not, when you throw the boy in there. And I could have thrown on, I finished college and your daughter finished college, and I could have hit him with the whole scenario of all these reasons why he is supposed to be nice and tame like me and you. But I asked the right question, thank goodness. Caught myself. And I said, does anybody want to guess what that question was? Yeah. It was, I said, okay. The okay was very important. Okay, so what is it that you want to do? Right. That's prefrontal lobes, so that's willing. We'll get there in just a second. And the answer floored me. The answer was, Dad, I want to be a Marine. Wow. Awesome. Scared me to death, but awesome. Because in that moment, I knew precisely what being a Marine meant. Because I knew what his gift sets were. I understood his temperament. And that, for him, was his path to greatness. And he went, and he came back with medals all over his chest. And I won't get into all the stories, because if I start talking about him, I'll spend the next hour talking about my son. All right? But an amazing turning point in his particular journey. Now, that isn't super serious, dangerous stuff, but at the same time, what I want you to recognize is that many kids, including your kids, reach that critical juncture in their development in which they become, as Charles Darwin understood, they become somewhat uneasy with what is and begin to think about what can be, what they can become. I mean, look at that second quote from Charles Darwin. Look into future generations. We can relax. And he wrote this in the late 1800s. This is not the Darwin you're used to hearing about. When I say Charles Darwin, what's the first thing you think? Survival of the fittest. All right? And the name of his book was Origin of the Species. Absolutely. All right? In which he saw us as my dog Thor. Animals. We just like, you know, so animal level. Well, guess what? And when I discovered this, it was mind-blowing to me, and I was happy I did, because the brain research is now picking up the theme. Darwin wrote a second book. Origin of the Species is the first half of his theory. And in that, he was only talking about my dog, Thor. He wasn't talking about you and me. He was saying, this is sort of the beginning. This is the lower brain system. In other words, he was talking about this and somewhat this here. And the beauty of his work is he was talking about this before the brain research even came along. The brain research has come in to confirm this. His second book is titled The Descent of Man. And I remember when I saw, I went out and I bought it. And there are amazing passages in this book in which Charles Darwin not only says, survival of the fittest does not explain you and I. That is an incomplete theory. And I'm going down this path because there are many who in the control theory world, it is based in large part on the belief that we have an inherent tendency to misbehave, an inherent tendency to be disobedient, an inherent tendency to do wrong. That is the origin of social control theory, that if left to our own devices, we would be aggressive and eat each other alive. And guess what? Not true. And even Darwin recognizes not true. His phrase was, and I love this phrase, he says, I have to say that when looking at you and I, There is a level of behavior that cannot be accounted for and explained by the laws of natural selection and survival of the fittest. He says, when I look at us, I say there has to be, and this is his phrase, higher agencies at work. Isn't that awesome? Something else, he said, is at work making us who we are. Now, the ancient Greeks had to figure this one out. I'm kind of a history buff. The ancient Greeks figured it out, and they pinpointed what was going on in my son's daring. The ancient Greeks said we all have within us a genius. No, those were the ancient Romans, a genius. There is something that makes Jonathan, Jonathan. There's something that makes you, you, and not me. So they called it your genius. There was ancient Greeks who called it your daimon, D-A-I-M-O-N. That there is a special thing inside of all of us. James Hillman in his book uses a much better term. He says we all are born with a fancy word, calling. There's something we're here to do. There's something that makes us us. Something that makes you who you are. And that the journey of life and the journey of development and that brain development essentially is about trying to figure out what that is and align one's life with it. That the research is very clear that the process of getting there requires that we go through some maladjustment, requires that we struggle in order to find it. There is something inside of us that makes us who we are. So in 1904, it was G. Stanley Hall who described adolescence and growing up and these teen years, described it as a time of storm and stress. And then later on came the social control theory that pretty much said, listen, there's a basic premise that we want to say is that human beings will misbehave when left to their own devices. And then control theory began to sort of generate this sense of we've got to set up very, very clear boundaries and put in place those things that will contain and control and keep behavior under control. And so when we go to Darwin, what we're now finding is that our researchers are moving rapidly to discover sort of what he sensed and knew. Now, this was written in 2011 in National Geographic magazine. And you can Google that and find that, but it is a wonderful, wonderful piece of work. It is the best article I've read that just breaks the brain research down into everyday common language. It calls it Beautiful Mind, or rather Beautiful Brains is the title of it. And when he looks at the stage of adolescence, he understands that what is going on with adolescent development is, in fact, a period of time in which the brain is doing exactly what it is supposed to do. There, they say, the job of moving out of the safety of the home into a complicated world, but it is also the job of becoming a greater human being, becoming what we're in the world to become. Now, here's what I want to say to you. There are a lot of effective practices. You heard some very, very good ones from our judge this morning, and I love the comment you made about when you look at the kids and there's the blank stare. And that blank stare is, I want to say, and to add to that, that blank stare is about a human being who, unfortunately, is clueless as to what they can become. Clueless. Because humans can't be like dogs and animals and pets who just do the same thing and just obey and just follow rules. And so what I want to say to you is that in the work that you're doing and the effective practices that you put in place, it is not only those specific practices, it is also how you do what you do. It's what the brain research is so powerful in helping us understand. How do you go about doing what you do? And the word I want to underscore here is what our kids desperately need in all that you're doing are models to see what they can become and to guide them. And I remember the moment for me, and every kid has these moments. And if I went around this room, we'd get these moments from everybody. I remember the moment when I got this sense of what was higher for me. Not just how do I get older, like animals get older. Animals get older. Right? But how do I go higher? How do I become this thing that is turning within me? I remember the day that it happened. And what I want to underscore for you is that in all the work you're doing, if we can give young people experiences, you want to know what works? Experiences with powerful models. I don't have a program name for that one. And you want to know why that's cool? Because it doesn't cost money. You put in the lives of kids experiences and people properly aligned with what might be their particular calling or their particular genius or their particular set of gifts. Yesterday, when I was with law enforcement folks and the workers there, we spent about 30 minutes on this. And there's a wonderful chart I developed on a list of gifts and talents that can be identified in young people. But I can remember the day when my particular gifts and talents locked in on the appropriate model. It was with my uncle in Atlanta, Georgia. I don't know. My mom was such a smart lady. She did two things that was very smart. But she did a lot of stuff that's smart. Having me was one of them. No. She did a lot of things that were smart. In the summer, I would spend most of my time not in the inner central city, but out with my grandmother. And my grandmother, well, grandmothers are great. And she developed a lot of important competencies that you're looking at right now. A lot of reading, lots of time spent, very important. But here was the other one. She was smart enough, and what I'm saying to you is what a family member did, but I'm saying this is what you can do. She was smart enough to do two things. Look into my eye and see my potential path to greatness. That's number one. When you look at these kids, are they cases? Or can you get past the case and see their potential path to greatness? Which might take a little conversation, which might take a little bit of getting to know them, but this was about age 11. That was the first thing. And the second thing she did is she arranged for me an experience that was a major turning point. And that experience was great. She sent me off to Atlanta, Georgia to be with my uncle and my cousins. And I remember the day because my uncle was a pastor of a church. Okay, you kind of see a connection there? So you know what I wanted to be when I was 11 years old, when I grew up, right? I wanted to be a preacher. And then when I went to college and figured out what that involved, I was like, I don't want to be a preacher. Like, oh, you do that too? I don't want to be a preacher. Right. But I knew that I needed to be on my feet doing what I'm doing today somehow, some way. I knew that that was in my calling, in my destiny, in my next higher thing. It was clear to me. Well, not that clear. It was more clear to my parents and my uncle. Anyway, but I remember the day he came out because he's a pastor, and he was also, get this, he was also a lawyer. But he's also a chaplain in the Army. And I would never forget the day. I got there, unloaded, the car came out, and now looking back, I know what he intentionally was doing. And I want to say this to you because one of the best things you all can do with all your policies, with all your programs, with all of your money, is construct experiences that turns the brain on and helps kids understand what they can become. This was a constructed experience, but when I was experiencing it, I didn't know it was constructed. I just thought my mom was sending me to Atlanta. Hey, cool. I'm going to see you in Atlanta. You're going to ride on a Greyhound bus all by myself. Yeah. Hallelujah, man. Come on, but guess what? I'm riding to Atlanta on a Greyhound bus all by myself, man. I'm cool. I had no idea what was going on. But my uncle walks out there, wonderful. And guess what he had on when he came to get me? Whew. Yeah, he had on his military uniform. That was so cool. Carrying his hat under his arm like this. Oh, it's just awesome. 11 years old. The human brain and children's brains have what I call mirror neurons. Don't ever forget this. You know what mirror neurons do? When you come home in the evening and you're upset, your kid's mirror neurons go, Mom's upset. I'm out of here. Mirror neurons feed off of the environment and feed off of the energy fields to which they're exposed. This is a very smart thing for nature to do because it's key to our survival. Nature said, hey, I'm going to put into these humans' brains mirror neurons so that when they're around the grown-ups, the offspring will pick up signals from the grown-ups because the grown-ups are going to be wonderful human beings. And all the grown-ups are going to be heroic and noble And all the grown-ups are going to be living their calling. And all the grown-ups are going to be fulfilled human beings. And then these offspring are going to be around these human beings. They're going to be picking up all that wonderful energy, and they're going to become great human beings. Those are mirror neurons. Mirror neurons pick that up and feed. And by the way, a kid can feel where you are long before you open your mouth or say a word. So they can sort of pick these things up. And so my uncle comes out, and I see this awesome uniform, the hat under the arm. He walks over to me, puts his arm around me. We go in, and I spent 2 weeks there with him being exposed to this incredibly powerful model, this image of what I could become. Now, researchers call it the hope for self, and they have looked at research on, and the research is called possible selves in delinquency. And guess what they found out? They found out the following, that the kids who engaged in delinquent behavior, guess what they were missing? The first question they were asked is, are you not aware that your behaviors can lead you to being into trouble and going to jail or whatever? And guess what most of the delinquents said? Yeah, I know that. So for those of you who are educating kids, it doesn't work. It's not an effective practice. They know. If you're spending a whole lot of time explaining to them that this will get you, they know. There's something else at work. When they press deeper, here's what they asked. They asked, what do you see yourself becoming? And the kids who engaged in delinquency, that's where they had the difficulty. Most of them saw themselves in what is called the feared self, as opposed to the hope for self. Here's the bottom line message for it. The research is this. And a guy named Jeffrey Swartz is doing a tremendous amount of work on this. This aspect of the brain called the prefrontal lobes involves the capacity to anticipate and envision the future, and the power of holding an internal mental image can literally do two things. It can change behavior and it can rewire the brain. Now, here's what's amazing. What this means is that the capacity of a young person to have in their brains, in their minds, the image, a positive image of what they can become is essential to development rising to a higher level. And without that image, they don't get there. What the researchers said was this, that having a feared possible self must be counterbalanced by a hoped for self. In other words, here's what they say. If all a kid does is have fear about what they can become that's bad, that it will cause them to freeze and become inactive and not progress and grow. But what's essential is that they have in their minds an image of what they could possibly become. Now, the question I often raise is that in our systems, at what point along the process and in the decision process, at what point do young people have the opportunity and are exposed to some thought, some idea, some notion about what they can become? Let me tell you how simple those kinds of moments are. I remember walking into my uncle's office in his church. He was sitting there at his desk, and I said, hey, Uncle Andy, what you doing? This is great what he did, because this is an adult saying, he is in process of figuring out his direction and course in life. My reply to this question is key. You've got a lot of young people right there that you're working with on your caseloads. And he looked at me and he said, I'm doing research on the law because I really want to understand this because I want to be the best possible lawyer I could be. And he said, come here, let me show it to you. And he's reading stuff to me, I didn't even understand it. But to this day, I am 53, and do you know that still emblazoned in my mind is this image of him sitting at his desk, hunched over, with his reading glasses on, with his big, thick legal book. And at 11 to 12 years old, that image was seared into my head. It just stayed there. And the reason I'm sharing it is to say, young people in their growth and development, that's those mirror neurons at work. So that the question becomes not whether or not young people will engage in these kinds of behaviors or not, but what kind of environment they will be in. and how we will expose them to the kinds of experiences they need to develop and become the kinds of human beings they in fact are set up to become. So that as we look at young people, as we look at development, as we look at the processes and the struggles through which they go, the question then becomes understanding what it is about them and what it is about their growth and development, what it is in their lives that we can lock into and that we can understand and grasp and support in their efforts to rise above where they currently are and become the kinds of human beings they can become. So in doing that, let me give you my quick skinny on the brain and how it works. Because it's a remarkable, remarkable, remarkable thing. First of all, the brain itself is not a conductor as such, but actually it's more of a transducer. Let me tell you what the brain does. And let me just toss out to see how many of you just think about it. The brain is designed to do one thing and one thing primarily. Some of you have heard me know this one, but anybody want to guess at that one? Our brain's primary job is our survival. Now, the brain does that by being a transducer. And here's what the word transducer means. It means the brain actually is set up not to run our lives, but to receive signals and to transmit those signals and turn those signals into information. You and I become a part of those signals, a part of the stimuli that are in the lives of young people. So think about this, because this is very simple. Think about a child walking, and have you noticed that you don't ever have to go to a child and say to a child, okay, one day you're going to have to walk, so let's make sure we start walking one day. And I don't know how many of you were around when your kid started walking, but wasn't that a magical moment? A magical moment. I mean, now I want you to think about this, because this is at the lowest levels, but it's extraordinary. How is it that this little child one day gets up and starts walking? You didn't tell him to. I mean, you can do it all you want. Hey, walk. Come on. All right, okay, I think next week, about 3 o'clock, we're going to start walking. How about that? Just doesn't work that way. No. No. Nature understands that for basic physical survival, that's the lowest level of survival, for basic physical survival, we have to what? Get up and we have to walk. And so those signals are sent to the brain because there's built-in, what are called built-in programs. I mean, Piaget calls them schemas. They're built-in programs, neural fields in the brain that are designed for walking. There's a whole neural field set up for walking, but that neural field has to turn on, and to turn on, it has to receive stimulus. Now, here's the point. What we do with kids, prepare them and prepare their brains to receive the stimuli that's needed for them to become who they are. Because of all of you who have your kids who are walking, what is it that you did? You remember what you did with them to help them learn how to walk? What's the first thing you did with them to help them learn how to walk? Well, first of all, they saw you walking. Now, if a kid grew up in a house where all the adults crawled around on their hands and knees, guess what? That kid would crawl around their hands and knees. That's the model. You had to see someone standing up and walking in order to prepare the brain to receive that signal out of the blue one day. I mean, it's truly a remarkable thing. This is happening down at the R system core brain level. Truly remarkable. We would pick them up and kind of carry them along, you know, let them kind of flop their legs along the floor. This is all stimuli that's preparing them to receive the signal when the brain and body is ready. Now, when my son was 19, that's when the signal for him finally broke through. He finally had the right alignment, but he had been prepared to receive that signal and then respond to it, just as with walking. Now, here's the beautiful thing. Walking is the simplest level. Maslow understood exactly what Darwin understood. Maslow says there's levels of survival. He said the physical level is the lowest level of all. After physical, there's safety. After safety, there's esteem and worth. I mean, there's belonging, and then there's esteem and worth, and finally there is self-actualization. There are higher levels. And here's the beauty of that. Just as the brain knows when to turn on those walking neurons, guess what? The brain also knows when to turn on empathy neurons. The brain knows how to turn on "I will care about you" neurons. The brain knows how to turn on "I will go to class every day" neurons. Brain knows how to turn those things on. But the question becomes, to what extent have we provided in terms of their life growth and experience the kind of stimulation that prepares those neural fields to receive that stimuli? The example I used when I was with him earlier here was the example of the cell phone, and I'll use it now. Most of you have one of these, right? And when it rings, what does that mean? It means it has received a signal, but nothing happens just by its ringing. In order for it to do what it needs to do, we have to push the button. That is, we have to allow that signal to do what that signal is equipped to do. And our work with them is sort of the pushing of the button. Protective factors is like pushing the green button. Those risk factors that you heard about earlier, that's pushing the red button. That is not allowing those signals to come through, not allowing those signals to work through. And as a result, kids aren't able to develop. So in order to develop, in order to grow, I want to share with you what I consider to be the three most basic developmental tasks in the lives of a young person. There are many versions of what developmental tasks are. I think those are the three that deals with that upward thrust, that upward mobility, that reaching a higher level. And I think that these are the questions that are being asked by kids, whether they verbally ask them or not. The first thing they want to know is, what kind of person am I? The second is, what kinds of things can I do well and can I achieve? And thirdly, what kind of person can I become? And that's where those four brain systems begin to work together. These are the questions that are working with them and with which they are struggling. And as I was looking at some of the research, the Gallup poll, the Gallup organization did an extraordinary poll on well-being, engagement, and hope, asking kids questions about their lives and development. And when it comes to well-being, that deals with the sensory level of life and the feeling level of life. They found out that 3 of 10 kids reported, by the way, it was about 2,600 kids, and it was done in 2009. 3 of 10 of them had a positive yesterday. So 30% of the kids who were spoken with or who did the survey said, yesterday was positive, and I was treated with respect. So that's lack of the kind of stimuli. Just as a child who learns to walk one day needs to get the proper stimuli in order for the brain to receive the signals that need to be received in order for them to walk and love and embrace and become what they're supposed to become, as they get older, they must still be getting that kind of support and encouragement to receive those signals. Guess what Joseph Pierce, the researcher, says? He says that the age range from 12 to about 16 or 17 is as delicate as when they were little infants, because the brain is that fragile in terms of its development. A lot of reorganization is going on. A lot of development is underway. So at least in this survey, 3 out of 10 said, didn't have a positive yesterday. In terms of engagement, engagement is key. In terms of allowing kids to discover, what kinds of things can I do well? And I'll wrap this up by coming back and talking about some of the key things. I'll give you, I think it's 8 things, specific kinds of practices that I think are absolutely key to provide this kind of support and provide this kind of stimulation. In terms of engagement, which has to do with what kinds of things can I achieve, in the survey of these 2,600 kids, 4 of 10 said that they had an opportunity to do what they do best every day. 4 of 10. Only 40% of the kids had a chance to do what I do best. This is important in terms of development. 3 of 10 said that I received some recognition or praise within the last 7 days. And 4 of 10 strongly agree that they feel safe in their schools. 4 of 10. That is not the kind of stimuli that sets the brain up. Actually, what it does is it causes the brain to remain locked into this core brain, which is where our primitive responses are. And let me tell you what those responses are. 3 basic responses, we all know them well. The 3 F's. I'll start it, you can finish it. Fight, flight, or close, or flee. Basic responses, primitive responses at the animal level. When a child is not getting the support and encouragement they need, these systems aren't being stimulated, and they fall back here, and they work at their lowest brain level, which is fight, flight, or freeze. Those are primitive responses. And so some of you, you work with kids, and you bring them in the office, and you look at them in the eye, and you say, hey, come on, what's going wrong with you? What, you know, talk to me. And do they talk? What part of the brain is needed for talking? You need the neocortex for talking. What's revving at a high level is that core brain. They are in defense mode. And then in terms of hope, hope is very, very important in terms of development, their research. 50% of the kids were hopeful. 6 of 10 were hopeful that they would get a good job one day. 3 of 10 said, I can deal with any problem. And this is the big one. 4 of 10 felt that they could energetically pursue their goals. In terms of looking at that broad brushstroke of what's going on in the lives of kids, what our interventions are about is setting up experiences and a field of environment and a field of stimulation that allows the brain to do what it is designed to do. The brain automatically says we want to work to a higher level. That's how those brain systems work. And in fact, that's how development itself works. As shown in this particular slide here, is those systems that you looked at gradually come online. They don't all pop in at the same time. So that there's a gradual process, a gradual growth and building, which these systems come together, and they begin with the first basic level. Remember the first one? What can I do? If that foundation is good, they can now move successfully to what can I achieve? If that foundation is successful, they can move to what is it that I can become? I'm thinking about my girlfriend's 5-year-old, and it's amazing. I love 5-year-olds because, hey, this little guy is just, he's almost right out of the research sometimes when I look at him, when you know the brain research. Because I go over and I've got a 5-year-old who loves to, guess what he loves to do in the summer? He loves to weed whack. All right. Little electric weed whacker. Of course, my girlfriend thinks I am the most magnificent man in the whole planet. Got his 5-year-old who wakes up in the morning and says, Mom, can I go weed whack? All right. But that's mirror neurons. Now, he's got some psychomotor gifts and abilities, and I can kind of see where he's headed. He loves John Deere tractors and trucks. He's just kind of got this thing. But I remember him looking at me out of the window, and those mirror neurons were at work. And he picks it up, and he goes out there. He can hardly hold it. He's dragging it along, right? All right. Picks it up. And he cranks it up. He says, show me how you do that again, Jonathan. Cranks it up. I finally show him how to get his fingers on it and hold it just right. And it takes off. Of course, he starts smiling when it takes off, right? And he puts it there, and he starts swatting the stuff, and the grass is going everywhere. And he's grinning from ear to ear. And then he stops, and he turns around, and guess what he asks? Close, but it's absolutely wonderful because he does it over and over again. He goes, I'm good at this, aren't I? I say, yes, you are. 5 minutes later, I'm really good at this, aren't I? Yes, you are. Very important for brain development. Go to the store to pick something up. Walk. I mean, the simplest of matters. He'll pick something up and he'll do A, B, and C, and he says, I did that good, didn't I? There's this built-in need, this built-in drive, this built-in thing in order to handle that very, very first level. You know, what is it that I can do, or that second level, what is it I can do, and what is it that I can achieve well? When that foundation is put in place, then they can move to these higher levels. But because here's what's happening when they're having all of those kinds of experiences. He is filling up what I call, there's a part of the brain called the hippocampus. That's the only fancy brain term I'm going to use today. But the hippocampus is very important because this is the spot where your kids that you're working with are in deep trouble in terms of what they can become. You know what the hippocampus is? It is the memory system for the computer. It holds everything in long-term memory. I call it the file system. So here's what you've got. You've got a five-year-old who's going, you good at that? Yeah. And then we go, oh, he loves to snow shovel with me. He's got his own snow shovel now. Little itsy bitsy snow shovel. Because he saw me out there snow shoveling for my girlfriend. And he goes, can I help? And what do you say to that? Sure, come on. And I'm going this way, and he's behind me, and I look back, and guess what? The snow I just shoveled, guess where it is? And I look back and say, man, do your own snow. He said, no, I like shoveling your snow. And then what do I do with that? Well, then get out of here, you knucklehead. No. Is it about the snow? It's not about the snow shoveling. I mean, it's not about the snow. It's about him being out there, having the connection and doing. And I look back and I say, good job, man, good job. And then he'll go and I'll go behind him. And then when he's not looking, I go. And he'll go, what you doing? I go, oh, there's a spot I missed. I just missed a spot. Because it's important to preserve the relationship and build this thing. Here's what I'm trying to do. I want to load his hippocampus. I want to load his file cabinet up with tons and tons of possible files to draw from when he reaches 14 or 15 and starts asking, what can I become? He needs a lot of material to draw from to create the inner image of what he can be. The kids you're working with don't have many files in their hippocampus file system. I did work in Miami, and I worked in one of the inner cities, and I worked it as a 4-square-mile area with about 15 to 16, 12 to 14-year-olds, and this particular part of Miami is only 35 or 40 minutes from wonderful Miami Beach. Whew. Miami Beach, the ocean, the wind, the waves. And of these 14 kids I was working with, not a single one of them at the age of 12 had ever been to the beach in their whole lives. Their world is 4-square-mile area. Their file systems, folks, is what? Very, very small. When they hit 13 or 14 and those prefrontal lobes kick in and the question becomes, in my positive maladjustment, what can I become? When they go to the file system, what do they have to pull? The guy down the street who beats people up, that's in the file system. The drug dealer, that's in the file system. The late night television with all this ridiculous, unbelievable, whatever, whatever, that's in the file system. And all of that isn't so bad if they could counterbalance that with some other stuff that's in the file system. And so we developed what I call a very, very effective practice, which was an experience. And guess what we found? Found this really cool guy who was into sailing. I didn't find it. The colleague I was working with worked with him. Would go out to Miami Beach and take them out on a boat for the very first time. And by the way, guess what? It was also first time for you know who. I've been on a motorboat, but I've never been on one of these dealies. The sailboats and all this. You should have seen these 13, 14-year-old kids. Ran, jumped out there. What a day it was. Now, some would say, so are you telling me that a boat experience can change someone's life? I hope that at this point in this presentation, you know that it's deeper than that. I am adding a file. I'm adding a file. So that when the judge looks at him and says, you've got to cut this out, you've got to become something one day, the blank stare won't be there. The blank stare is there because the brain is checking the file system, and guess what's in the files? Drugs. Hanging out, nothing there. So the deeper and the richer and the broader these experiences, it's how critical it is. Some of you and I, we do some of this stuff without even thinking about it. But But please understand that this is what disadvantaged children means. What does disadvantaged mean? Let me tell you what it means. What it means is that in our society now, to get a lot of files put in takes what? Unfortunately, just a lot of stuff you gotta pay for. It's kind of like not the way it used to be. I mean, when I would go out in the country with my grandmother, it was great because she didn't have running water. So guess what file I got filled in? How to use an outhouse. Great file. Guess what another file I got? You're going to milk the cows and churn the buttermilk. I actually churned buttermilk. That was great. My uncle across the street traded dogs and horses and that kind of stuff, so I'd go out with the horses. He tried to teach me how to call the cows to come eat. I'm not going to even try to attempt it, but he had this whooping, hollering call, and the cows would come, and I'd walk out there. He'd say, okay. He'd call me Big Grape. Don't ask me why he called me Big Grape, but he called me Big Grape. He said, hey, Big Grape, because I like knee-high grape sodas. I don't know if they even make those anymore. He said, hey, Big Grape, call the cows. And I would try it, and do you think they came? Cows never came. You know, and sometimes I'd go out there by myself when he wasn't looking, and I'd go, I try it. Cows will never come. But all I'm saying is this is filling up the file cabinet. Wide range of experiences. When kids are disadvantaged, their file system is about that big. And you can punish and contain and mandate all you want. It puts nothing in the file system. Nothing. Oh, it does. It adds a few more bad files. Because it just got screamed at by this person sitting behind a bench with his big robe on who thinks he's God. And he just screamed at me, so that's in the file system now. And I just got told I'm going to amount to nothing by some kid. That's in the file system. Now, understand that some of that has to happen. We've got to counterbalance that with some positive stuff that's there. But you and I take it for granted. I mean, my son at 11 years old is sitting with me in an airplane because he wants to go see Washington, D.C. And then later he fell in love with the New York Mets. And so he goes, Dad, can we go to New York? And guess what I said? Sure. So off we go to New York. Only because I fly all the time and I had enough miles where I could fly around the globe 50,000 times. So it wasn't that I had a whole lot of money. It's that he just lucked out with me having all of these miles piled up. But I'm filling up his file system, filling up his hippocampus with great stuff to draw from. So what I want to say to you is that the brain will automatically work through its stages of development. But when they reach that 14, 15, 16 stage level, the brain is now asking, what are you going to become and what can you become? And it's critical at that point that they have a good file system in. And the reason I say that stage of development, here are those prefrontal lobes, and it lines up with right about age 15. You have this on your disc. You can look at this to all your heart's content once you get home or wherever. But this is the stage. And the further up we go, here's where it gets challenging. These are the lower instincts that Darwin talked about. These are the higher instincts. All right? The further, even though this goes downward, the further up the system we go, the more delicate and refined the stimuli has to be. I want you to understand that. When they're here, it's sensory stimuli. Just walk around, pick them up, move them around, show them things. But the further up we go, especially once we get here, now we have to pay close attention to who we are. We've got to pay close attention to the kind of environments we put them in. Now the stimuli they need is high-level kinds of stimuli. And I was very, very aware of that with my son, and I wanted him to see, A, and understand, A, what a true man was. And I wanted him to understand that in terms of how he related to and talked to girls. And so now the stimuli needs to be more delicate. And I found a wonderful way. And I'm just sharing this as a very, very simple example of how to develop the proper stimuli. Very simple example. Because he would love to get movies. And so I would pick him up on, we were divorced, I'd pick him up on Fridays. The first stop was, of course, the supermarket because my refrigerator was totally empty. So after we made that stop, then we would go over to, then in those days, Blockbuster. Now you can order them from wherever. You don't need Blockbuster anymore. But we'd go to Blockbuster, and it was kind of cool to watch what movies he picked because it showed me kind of what his interest level was. It showed me what his sparks, and I'm going to close on that note, what his sparks were, right? Because that's the part that shows you what you can become. We'd get home, pop it in, sit down and eat, and invariably there would be some scene where a woman, in my view, was not being properly respected or treated well. And I would lean over to him and I'd go, "What do you think about that?" And we'd have a brief discussion about it. I used television watching to teach him about that, but guess what I had to do now? I had to pay close attention to whom? Myself. That's right. Because those mirror neurons at work. And so when I would go pick up my girlfriend, I was very careful to do it. This was so neat. I was so careful to simply open the door for her. Very subtle stimuli. And it was so funny because when I went home to see my son and we walked out of the house, guess what he did? He walked over the door, opens the door. So it's the modeling and elevating the level of stimuli. I used to share with him a lot of my stories, a lot of the work that I was doing, and I remember when he became a Marine, he was based in Washington, D.C., and so sometimes this sort of stuff can backfire on you, but it was frightening to me because they had just built the Marine Corps Museum. And when I flew in, he said, "Dad, I want to take you to the Marine Corps Museum," and guess what the first exhibit he took me to? Scared me to death because he hadn't been deployed to Iraq yet. So I go to his base, we get in the car, we drive over there. He goes, "Dad, come on, I want to show you the coolest exhibit." I'm like, "Okay, I'm with you. Finally get there, he takes me to the exhibit of all the martyrs. And he goes, "Dad, read that one right there." And I read it. And it was a story of a Marine who saved his whole platoon by jumping on and laying over a hand grenade. And I finished reading it, and I looked at him, and he goes, "Man, isn't that cool?" It's like, oh. But here's what do you know what that symbolized for him? Honor, courage, duty. He had absorbed all of this stuff in terms of his own growth and development. And when he came back, the most wonderful conversation I had with him at 25 years old was about 8 months ago when he called me after he got his first job as a police officer. He called me up, 25, and it finally hit. And I think that in terms of the work we do with kids, these are the moments, because I'm going to close with a story about an assistant principal who pretty much did the same thing for me, but he wasn't my parent. But he called me up and he said to me, he said, "Dad, I just want to thank you." It's the first time he's ever done this. 25. "I just want to thank you," he said, "because you, Dad, you have been my model. You've been my example. And I'm glad I'm a cop now because, Dad, I don't really know," but he was struggling with the words because he's not the verbal type. That's my gift. I'm the yakety, yakety, yakety guy. He's the physical guy. Want something handled, call Darren to handle. Want somebody to talk you to death, call me. All right. But he managed to get the words out. He managed to say, "I just feel, Dad, that it's my calling to go out and protect people." Click. It's like click, 25. He's there because this stage of growth and development can extend out quite a bit further. Up until age 30 or 31 is when the prefrontal lobes can finish developing. Now, here's the cool thing. Guess what nature says? You've got in your materials, in some of the extra materials, one on brain mapping. So look at that when you get home. But the brain has what's called gray matter. And gray matter is what's there when the brain is still working to set up its connections. Now, here's the beautiful thing. Here's what the brain says, what nature says. Nature says, based on the stimulation you get, and therefore, the neural connections you develop, at those stages, 1, 4, 7, 11, 15, 21, those are growth spurts. At each of those stages, we're going to release a substance that will eliminate all those existing neurons that are sitting there waiting to be used that weren't used, and we're going to release a substance called myelin to lock in the connections that you have been using a lot. Do you understand what that means? For a kid whose file cabinet is small and who has been using his defense systems most of his life because he grew up in a home with a lot of domestic violence, it means that nature is saying, "Oh, I get it. This is what nature is saying to the brain. I get it. You live in an environment where you might get beat up at any moment. So therefore, we're going to lock in your neural track for aggression. There is a specific track for aggression. It's called aggression, rage, and violence. We're going to lock that one in and make sure that one is easily accessible. Because based on the stimulation you've been getting, the signals mean you live in an environment that's like that. Now, that worked for us back when we lived where? In the caves. Because when you woke up in the morning, there might be a saber-toothed tiger outside the cave, right? So you might better wake up with your what? Your spear. And the first thing you might better do is look out the cave and make sure it is not something you need to kill. But we don't need that anymore. But a kid who grows up in an environment of constant fear, constant threat, and trauma, that system has been locked in. Here's the beauty. And so when it locks in, the gray matter recedes and white matter takes over. That's the myelin that locks in those neural tracks. But guess what nature does, which is so cool? The gray matter stays for a very, very long time here at the prefrontal lobe level. And it doesn't begin to lock in until they reach about 16, 17, or 18. In other words, nature says, we're going to wait. And we're going to give you plenty of time to figure out this level. And then once you hit about 18, 19, or 20, the gray matter begins to now recede, the myelin locks in, which means that's a massive window of opportunity. What I want to say to you is, your kids, they're tough, they're chronic offenders, they're difficult, but there's still an amazing window of opportunity. There's still a chance. So let me give you eight things specifically in terms of the kind of stimuli that's needed then to make sure that hippocampus file cabinet is packed with cool stuff. They're still going to go through a period of maladjustment because they're going to be looking at their environment saying, how can I go to a higher level? But in terms of your work and whatever program you implement, I want you to think not just about the program, but about what are the kids experiencing. These wonderful stories you heard from my judge preceding me will give you experiences of kids that were awful experiences. So for the sensing level and the sensory level, two things are very, very important. Make sure there are experiences of comfort and safety. And what's cool about this is it doesn't cost money. There's comfort and there's safety. And what we want to protect them from are high levels of anxiety and fear. Not good for brain development. For the limbic system that begins to come online later on, and thank you so much for always coming up here doing this. I really appreciate it. And I need you to do it one more time for my closing remarks. I appreciate it. So for the limbic system, when it comes online, here are the two characteristics of experience: joy and pleasure. Wonderful research on this. Pleasure is essential in order for brain connections to form in a positive way. Never forget that. It's important that your kids look back at you, it's very simple, and they say, geez, I'm having, yeah. That is great work. You might think, you're not supposed to be having fun. You're supposed to be scared because you're in trouble. Go ahead and take care of that and get that out of the way. Give them experience with having joy and pleasure. And here's a tricky thing. Once they reach 15 or 16, dopamine levels drop. Dopamine is the substance that makes us feel good. Yay! That's dopamine. The reason young kids are easy to entertain is because the brain releases tons of dopamine for very simple things. That's because nature's very smart. Nature said, we want to make sure that most kids have every chance in the world to grow up how? Happy. Happy. So with Max, I can stop at the little mobile gas station and buy him a $1.50 plastic gun with caps on it. This past Saturday before I left, we spent 3 hours with this little cap thing because his dopamine was just all over the place. Joy and pleasure. And that's important for the brain systems to connect. K because the brain releases it easy. Now, if I could do that with a 15-year-old, there's a problem. Big problem. Because at around 13 or 14, the brain does something very unique, and your parents are going to hate this. The brain shifts, and it says that the release of dopamine is going to require far greater stimulus. That's why a 12 or 13-year-old becomes very, very bored very easily. Nature is smart. Nature says, we're going to make you want a whole lot of novelty. The press for novelty. Give me something new. Because they understand that to get this stage of development rolling, there's got to be higher levels of stimuli. And that, in terms of the National Geographic article research, means the kid has to get out of the what? Got to get out of the house. That's why your 12 or 13-year-old suddenly looks at you and goes, what? Yeah, I'm out of here. Yeah. Yeah, I remember Darren. Oh, it was so funny. Up until the time he was 12 or 13, he would cuddle up to me to watch TV. And by the way, dads, it's okay to be affectionate to your sons. Okay? Not a problem. My son, I hug all the time. All right? And he went to Iraq and kicked butt. Okay? So you're not going to, it gives them a tremendous amount of security in terms of their growth and development. But he hit 13 or 14, and it was like, hey, Dad, bye, Dad. As soon as he got it, it's just gone, all the time. All right? Because guess what? I was no longer equipped with enough stuff to hold his what? Interest. Thank you. And I'm not supposed to be equipped for that. He's supposed to get out of the house. That's nature's plan. That's what the National Geographic article is about. It is now time to go through this positive maladjustment. And the positive maladjustment is, I don't like being around here anymore. I need to go out. And he needs adventure. He needs to grow. He needs to develop. So that becomes essential. The brain level, the brain capacity to produce dopamine requires much more intense experiences in order for that dopamine to flow. And he went out and got it. And your peers become the most important source for that. So joy and pleasure. So the older they get, the harder it is for them to experience pleasure. Please understand. Which is why substance abuse is so easy. Because substance abuse is an artificial way to get your dopamine flowing. You just go, woo, dopamine flows. Artificial. But nothing else is providing it for me. So joy and pleasure. At the thinking level, provide challenge and participation. Those are the two key elements there. Challenge and participation. Because now we're moving up to this stage where the environment must involve high levels of stimulation. So the environment needs to be challenging, and they've got to be something in which they are, the researchers call it mastery motivation. They've got to master something. They've got to be able to look back and say, I did that. I mastered that. Vygotsky calls it the zone of current development and the zone of proximal development. The current development is what I can do now by myself. Proximal development is the next highest level where I need some help and assistance. I might fail at it, but I learned it and I got good at it. Those are the critical kinds of experiences kids need. Our justice systems have got to find ways to put them in locations and opportunities that provide that. And finally, here at this level, the seventh and eighth, experiences that provide accomplishment and recognition. Those eight things work. And there are any number of strategies and approaches you can use to get there, some of which clearly don't necessarily, in my view, cost a whole lot of money. The researchers did some great work in terms of looking at young people and figuring out that since this thing about the brain is actually there, how do we get rid of the vacant look in the eye? And how do we allow them to have a sense of what they can become? And I love what the Children's Foundation and the Best Buy Children's Foundation Research Institute did. They did a wonderful piece of research work and identified that the one thing in the lives of teens that make a tremendous difference is identifying their sparks. And I love the word sparks because it so links with what you were saying. The eyes are vacant. There's no sparkle or spark in the eye, right? Which means they have no sense of what they can become, which means now the brain is all disassociated. It's not linking together. It's not locked together. It isn't weaving together. They're lost is what you're seeing. Identifying their sparks. Here's the three things. First of all, do the kids know their sparks? I was fortunate because I was surrounded by adults who looked into my eye and saw what could be my path to greatness. Is your spark important to you? Well, my uncle came in and took care of that, because guess what my uncle did? It was so cool. My uncle looked at me one day and said, hey, how would you like to do a revival meeting for me? I don't know how many of you are familiar with that. In the black church tradition, we do these revival meetings, which you come in every night, and a preacher preaches every night, called gospel revival meetings. So he's basically asking me to preach. I'm 12. Is that not amazing? That's the right move. Because I went, you mean like preach like you? And he goes, yeah. And I went, okay. What are you going to say, right? No, I don't want to preach, okay? No, I'm not going to preach. Yeah. He identified it, and he made it to be important. And by the way, I did. I still have the old scrapbook, and he, 12 years old, he allowed me to stand up in front of, and don't ask me if the sermon was any good. Clueless. Not important. Gave me the experience and the opportunity. That's a sense of accomplishment and recognition. The eighth one on your point. And then you take initiative to develop your spark. And guess what the researchers did? They took those three things and they said, if those three things are in place, then their spark level is high. If it's not in place, their spark level is low. And look at the outcomes. In order to get them to focus on their school stuff, guess what? You didn't have to have a special intervention to say, okay, you're not doing right in school, so we're going to send you to the I'm going to do better in school group. No, the brain knows, didn't I tell you? The brain knows when to say it's time to walk. The brain knows when to turn on the neurons for study and academic achievement. Don't worry about that. Take care of what is it, what kind of person am I, what can I do and achieve, what can I become? You take care of that. Providing those eight kinds of things, the brain knows when to tell them to, okay, hit the books. And if they have some impairments, some difficulties, get the tutoring for it. Don't you love this, a sense of purpose about the future? Believe it's important to help others. The one that is very high is the grade average. But the thing I love about this is that is what it is basically saying to us is that we are hardwired for health. We are hardwired for well-being. The brain knows what to do if we can expose the brain to the right environments and the right support. And so I take my hat off to you for the kind of work that you're doing and for where you're sitting, because you're in the position to do what my assistant principal did for me when I got into trouble. And he looked at me and he said, Jonathan, because I think he was able to see that there is in your eye a spark. And I remember the title, because it was called Class Disruptiveness, whatever that means. But basically, it meant I wouldn't keep my mouth shut in class. Are you surprised? Let me tell you the difference between a gift and a talent. A gift is the raw ability. A talent is using it skillfully. I had the raw ability to be verbal, but I wasn't using it skillfully. Was getting me into trouble. And I love what my assistant, I'll never forget his name, Mr. Charles Morris, an amazing man. I love him to this day. Because that assistant principal, in his role of disciplinarian, looked into my eyes and said, you can be in the Optimus Club speech contest and give speeches. I had no idea what that meant. But he said, you're going to go to Ms. Carol Vogler's office and she's going to help you put your speech together, which I dutifully did. Because when you guys get kids at the point that you get them, most of them don't want to keep doing bad. Please trust me on that one. There's a small percentage that we've lost. Most do not want to keep doing bad. But we have not given them the way to go positive. He did in that moment. And I joined that whole thing. And the Optimist Club speech contest was life-changing, life-turning for me. I mean, I remember I joined, developed my speech, and I gave, I don't know, tons of speeches, and I went to the state finals. But that was the beginning, because at that point, seventh grade, it was clear what I could become. Now the researchers call it cognitive restructuring. Do you know what that means? It means that I began to see my environment through my spark. And that's where you want kids. Because guess what I began asking? What can I do with my ability to speak? Oh, I can join the debate team. So I did. Didn't know you had to do research. Debate the positive and the negative. No, positive and affirmative. All right. Get up and look. That's okay. Oh, what else can I do? Cool. Student government. Because all I got to do is give a good speech and all the kids vote for you. So I did that. Student government. 8th grade, 10th grade, 12th grade. Student body president. Didn't know you had to run meetings, learn Robert's Rules of Orders, plan things, be responsible for stuff, developing all these competencies. Oh, I could also draw on the drama club. Didn't know you had to memorize big, thick things of lines. But through my spark, cognitive restructuring, I began to reconnect. Problem behavior, misbehavior kind of vanished. But it was then that I got the sense of who I was to become. And I can say to you honestly today, that of all the people, my mom, my grandmother, my uncle, Charles Morris, had a tremendous amount to do with why I'm standing here in front of you today. And for you all, you're in the position to do precisely the same thing with scores of kids every single day. Identify and develop a structured experience that allows them to discover, value, and develop their sparks. And the brain would take care of itself. Thank you, guys. Appreciate it.